Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Thursday, the 7th of November. As the world prepares for the return of Donald Trump to the US presidency in 2 months' time, what impact could his tariff policy have on the world economy, including on our own? We'll hear from wine and spirit makers and from Wilbur Ross, Mr. Trump's former Commerce Secretary. How much humble pie is Foreign Secretary David Lammy eating as he attempts to move on from previously describing the president-elect as a tyrant in a toupee? Chris Mason has asked him. How should political leaders across the continent of Europe respond to the imminent shift of power in Washington? Well, as it happens, they've been discussing just that in Budapest. And can they respond when both the French and German governments are in political paralysis? I've been joined by the UK's former ambassador in Paris and Washington and by the parliamentary spokesman of Germany's governing Social Democrats. We hear from Australia on the government's plan to ban those under 16 from social media and why Rory McIlroy thinks it could be Donald Trump peacemaker in the world of golf. Donald Trump has given his first interview since winning Tuesday's election. Speaking by phone with the US network NBC, he told the interviewer he'll go ahead with plans for mass deportation of illegal immigrants regardless of the cost. "We have no choice," he said, "when people have killed and murdered, when drug lords have destroyed countries, and now they're going to go back to those countries because they're not staying here. There is no price tag." Describing his election as a victory for common sense, he expressed delight at winning big among traditionally Democratic Party supporters, including Latino Americans. "I started to see realignment could happen because the Democrats are not in line with the thinking of the country." Well, the defeated Democratic Party candidate for US President Kamala Harris spent much of her four-month campaign trying to convince voters that the economy is healthy. So it may have been bitter for her party, licking its wounds from Donald Trump's clear-cut victory, to hear Jerome Powell, chair of the US Federal Reserve, explaining tonight that the quarter-point interest rate cut the bank announced a couple of hours ago, thus, "Some of the downside risks to economic activity having been diminished, and so overall feeling good about economic activity." Prices pushed up by inflation haven't fallen back, even though the rate of the increase has slowed, and that has hit what Americans call their pocketbooks hard. The question for many people there, and indeed for those of us in this country who trade with the United States, is whether the president-elect's policy prescription, in particular tariffs on imports, will help or hinder economic activity. Miles Beale is chief executive of the UK Wine and Spirit Trade Association. He's been telling me about the effect the policy had on his industry when then-President Trump imposed tariffs the first time around.
Essentially, in sort of 2018 and 19, US tariffs were imposed on steel and aluminium, and so the EU imposed a 25% retaliatory tariff on American whiskey. And as part of the WTO Boeing Airbus dispute, the US imposed another retaliatory tariff on Scotch malt whiskey, Irish whiskey, and other liqueurs from lots of European countries, actually. And it then took until sort of somewhere between 2021 and 2022 to agree between the EU, the UK, and the US to suspend those tariffs. But the truth is they're actually paused, so they will come back into play in 2025 and 2026. If they are not resolved on a permanent basis or aren't suspended for a further period of time.
And therefore your fear is that when Donald Trump walks into the White House at the end of January next year, he will say lift the pause.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. Lifted early, or indeed, worse still, those tariffs could be doubled. So there's been talk previously of them being increased from 25% to 50%. The main thing that we'd be after is for the UK government to get on and negotiate with the Trump administration when it comes in order that this doesn't happen. In effect, it's live because they kick back in 25 or 26. And really what we want is to take advantage of the way that we think a Trump administration is likely to work and, you know, do a deal with them.
If it did kick back in, what would be the effect on the industry here?
The effect would be pretty dramatic in that exports to the US from the UK are worth about £1.4 billion worth a year, according to HMRC. So that is what we'd be at risk of losing. And I think that would be a big problem. Of course, it's mutual. There's products coming the other way as well. But in general terms, tariffs are unhelpful for free trade and don't help grow the economy.
Miles Beale. So should his industry and indeed the rest of us be worried? The businessman Wilbur Ross was US Commerce Secretary under Donald Trump from 2017 to 2021 and one of the architects of his first tariff regime. I asked Mr. Ross how determined President Trump is to re-implement those tariffs once he returns to office.
He's always been in favor of tariffs as a good solution, but you shouldn't necessarily take 100% literally when he talks about tariffs. He uses it sometimes as a kind of metaphor to make clear to the public that his policy will be tougher.
Is it in some sense a negotiating strategy then to other countries to say, look, we'll impose this tariff unless you offer us something that makes that less attractive to us?
Well, the threat of tariff is important. The threat of tariffs on automobiles last time clearly resulted in a migration of some factories to the U.S. And this time, his threat of tariffs on Chinese EVs clearly has led to their wanting to relocate some production to Mexico and places of that sort. There's no question that his use of threats will have an impact on decisions made abroad, and those in turn will influence what he does next.
The administration imposed a 25% tariff on steel and 10% on aluminium, or what you call aluminium imports from China, in March 2018. You were quoted at the time as saying they were meant to modify China's behaviour. Did they?
Oh, sure it did. There's no question about that. There's no question that it helped the American steel industry. The problem with statistical comparisons is people say, oh, well, it only added so many jobs to steel itself, and they say, therefore, it didn't do much. Well, that's not the right comparison. Without the tariffs, there would have been a large reduction in the number of jobs in that industry, and therefore, the right comparison is not between some theoretical base and what happened, but rather between what happened and what would have happened.
Mr. Trump has talked about a 10% across-the-board tariff. The British government estimates that would cost the UK £20 billion.
Yes.
Is that a way to treat an ally?
As I say, he often talks about tariffs in a kind of metaphorical way. I think he's quite aware and appreciative of the special relationship between UK and US. When it comes to actual decision making, the end result may be different. I think a lot will also depend, particularly with the EU countries, on whether people step up to pay their fair share of the NATO and other defense expenditures. He was repeatedly very upset during the first administration that people didn't pay their fair share. And now, with the Ukraine situation, it's even more essential that those countries raise it.
Former Trump cabinet minister Wilbur Ross. Now, remember, tyrant in a toupee? A picaresque description of President Trump offered by David Lammy, an opposition backbencher at the time, and now British Foreign Secretary. Our political editor, Chris Mason, has been speaking to him. Has he been eating large slices of humble pie?
He has, with a garnish of diplomacy upon them, I think, Sean. So here we have the UK's now chief diplomat, who, to put it gently, was not remotely diplomatic about Donald Trump for years on end on social media and indeed in Time magazine and elsewhere. Not mild admonishments, not a splash of the lightest criticism, but as you were hinting at there, absolutely the strongest possible criticism. And now he finds himself as Foreign Secretary. Now, he's been on the BBC's Newscast podcast this evening. They were keen to come on. He was keen to come on. And I think they've decided that he had to just sort this out, face the questions, and then hope that he can move on. But before we got to some of that, I was asking him about his feeling about the election results. And he said, from his frequent crossings of the Atlantic in the last few months, he'd thought for some time it was pretty likely that Donald Trump would win.
I was a little bit surprised that the Democrats had made a decision not to centre particularly the economy in their approach to the election. We obviously had been really clear about growth. For us, we knew that the cost of living crisis, that's where the public...
So was your hunch that Trump was going to win?
I've got to say it was. I felt in my bones that there could be a Trump presidency.
Now, if you have the mild inclination for a splash of cynicism, you might say that he would say that now, wouldn't he? But nonetheless, that is his argument. So what about the whole business of building bridges with somebody who, frankly, you've spent years slagging off?
What I'm saying is I've met the man.
Mm.
And in the end, diplomacy, but actually just common manners is in it particularly, is building relationships with people. And I think he's someone that we can build a relationship with in our national interest, because we must.
Common manners, says the man who described his dining partner as you were saying, a tyrant in a toupee. So, yeah, there is the attempt from David Lammy to try and draw a veil over all of that. He was making an argument that said, look, loads of people had said some pretty disobliging things about Donald Trump. That is true, although I did put to him that, you know, on the league table of fruity quotes, his were amongst the fruitiest, and he is now the foreign secretary. He also said, in our interview, that he is willing and the government is willing, if Donald Trump puts up tariffs, import taxes significantly, as he has said he will, that the UK will be making a pretty strong argument to a long-time ally that that would be a mistake. So that just the beginnings of what are plenty of interesting conversations to come. The bottom line is, Sean, the Foreign Secretary's job in the last 48 hours has become a whole lot harder.
Chris Mason, our political editor. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much. Well, the president-elect was on their minds at the European Political Community Summit today too. By coincidence, political leaders from both inside and outside the EU were in Budapest, hosted by perhaps Mr. Trump's most enthusiastic European ally, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Of more immediate concern to many of those present was what a Trump presidency could mean for Ukraine, and whether Europeans should be ready to fill any gap left by the potential withdrawal of American support. President Volodymyr Zelensky was quick to emphasise the importance of the US-European relationship to both sides.
Yesterday I spoke with President Trump, as many of you did, and it was productive conversation, good conversation. Of course, we cannot yet know what his actions will be, but we do hope that America will become stronger. And this is the kind of America that Europe needs. And a strong Europe is what America needs, to my mind. This is the connection between allies that must be valued and cannot be lost.
Well, that's in contrast to French President Emmanuel Macron's message in the immediate aftermath of Donald Trump's election victory that the continent should respond with, quote, a more united, stronger, more sovereign Europe. There was a more defiant response, too, from Finland's Conservative Prime Minister Petteri Orpo.
We have to give a clear message here today to the United States and the new administration that we support Ukraine as long and as much as needed.
Well, Sir Peter Westmacott spent 5 years as British ambassador to France, followed by 4 years as ambassador to the United States. Sir Peter, thank you very much for being with us on The World Tonight. How big a headache is this for Europe?
I think it's a very big headache, as you would put it, because what you've got in President-elect Trump is somebody who is very strongly America first, who believes that the priority is to solve America's internal problems. He doesn't have much time, to put it mildly, for most international organizations and institutions. He doesn't like the climate change agreements from Paris. He doesn't like the European Union. He doesn't much care for NATO, mainly because, rightly, in my view, he has argued that the United States has had to shoulder more than its fair share of the burden. So we do need to adjust and to recalibrate. And there's a lot of things going on in the world which make this more urgent, leaving aside, you know, the crises in the Middle East and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You've got things like the BRICS meeting in Russia the other day, which Vladimir Putin said was the beginning of the creation of a new just world order. In other words, a challenge to the, if you like, liberal democratic system that we all put together after the Second World War based on rule of law and transparency and separation of truth from fiction and all the other values that we hold dear. So Europe has got to face up to its own destiny and not rely as much as it has in the past on the United States doing all the heavy lifting and looking after its security.
Should we be preparing now for a possible reduction in, or indeed complete end to, American financing of Ukraine's military activities in defending itself? Should we, and are we willing, do you think, to fill any vacuum that's created?
I think one of the first serious foreign policy discussions that the British government needs to have, not just the British, but, you know, we have taken a lead on Ukraine, so it does fall to us with the Ukraine, with the Trump team, is a discussion of support for Ukraine. I mean, David Cameron went down to Mar-a-Lago when he was still the foreign secretary, and I think was instrumental in helping persuade Donald Trump not to block the famous $61 billion of military assistance that was approved earlier this year. And I think that given President-elect Trump's desire to be the great dealmaker in chief, it is a very powerful argument, and I think the right argument, to say to him that it won't be a very good deal if you find that one of the parties that you bring to the table hasn't got any chips to play or any strong cards, to mix my metaphors. So we need to talk to them and get the United States and the incoming administration to grasp that the only decent deal for Ukraine that is good for America's security as well as European security, let alone the poor people of Ukraine, is going to be one where Ukraine has got some real assets, something to trade with, and the America pulling the plug on military assistance and economic support for Ukraine would be a terrible mistake and against America's interests.
Just one last brief thought. We're going to talk in a moment about the political crisis in Germany. I just wonder, from your perspective, how big an obstacle to European preparations for Trump's second term is having both France and Germany experiencing political paralysis?
He never had a lot of time for the European Union. We've known that the coalition government in Germany was likely to collapse for some time. It hasn't been, I'm afraid, quite as strong as many of us would have wished. And you've got President Macron, whose political position is weak as well. Now, from Trump's point of view, I don't think that makes a huge amount of difference. He's looking at tariffs. He's looking at trade policy. He's looking at delivering on some of the promises he's made to the American people. I think there is a very important role for the United Kingdom to play here. We're not in the European Union, but there is a role that we can play because we are a significant military player in the European side, and we can speak to America about trade policy independently of the rest of the European Union, as well as trying to make the arguments I was mentioning just now about defence expenditure in Europe and strengthening Ukraine.
Sir Peter Westmacott, former British ambassador to both France and the United States, thanks very much. And we'll stay with Germany, because the dismissal by the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz of his finance minister Christian Lindner, which I mentioned last night, he's the leader of the Free Democrats, a liberal party which is one of three making up the coalition government, or I should say was. Mr. Lindner's three FDP colleagues walked out of the cabinet after their leader was sacked from it. The Green Party says it'll stay in the coalition, and of course Chancellor Scholz's Social Democrats are the dominant party in government. But with a vote of confidence scheduled for January, almost certain to be followed by elections in March, both the governments of the continent's big pairs are, as I said, now facing both parliamentary defeat, or the risk of it, failure to set a budget, and political paralysis. Neil Schmidt is parliamentary spokesman for the Chancellor's SPD party. You were part of the negotiations, Mr. Schmidt, in helping to set up the coalition. What's gone wrong?
Well, what went wrong is the irresponsible manner the finance minister dealt with the latest budget. Unfortunately, he was not up to the task of building the necessary compromise among the three coalition partners to have a majority for the budget. Despite that, we had a rather solid agreement at the beginning of this term, and especially on foreign policy, we had a broad consensus for supporting the European Union and the international order. So It's very unfortunate, but if one party leader is incapable of behaving responsibly, we have to live with the consequences.
Right. I mean, the Chancellor's accused him of petty political tactics. What exactly was he referring to? Simply the disagreement over the budget?
Yeah, and the idea that a finance minister should serve the whole of government to solve all the matters related to the budget. But instead of this, Mr. Lindner pursued a very ideological agenda and was more preparing the next election than doing his job.
And but isn't the sacking of the finance minister a terrible signal to send both to German citizens and indeed to potential investors in Germany?
No, because better get rid of the worst finance minister we've ever had than continue this strategy. Now we have a very solid minority government in place, which is politically cohesive,
very unpopular, isn't it? I mean, you look at the polling, political polling aggregate puts the centre-right Conservatives, the CDU, the big opposition party, on 32%. It puts you on 16% and the Greens, your remaining coalition partner, on 10%. Presumably that's why the Chancellor wants to delay the election until next spring.
No, there are some issues that need to be resolved with the current parliament in place, especially on Ukraine and some matters related to industrial policy and the protection of jobs in our economy. And, you know, polls are going up and down. Before the last general elections, we had a similar polling situation, and in the end, the SPD won.
Do you think you'll win again in March?
Yeah, of course.
That's very the whole confident. Idea.
Well, that's the whole idea of making clear to the people that the problem is not about the Chancellor or the Green Party, but about the Liberal Party, which was not ready to serve the country and to govern properly. And now at least Scholz has the opportunity to show to the people that he is ready to govern. And we'll see what comes out of the next election, right?
We will indeed. Neil Schmidt, parliamentary spokesman for the SPD party in Germany. Thank you very much for talking to The World Tonight. Coming up between now and the end of the programme, Donald Trump once again touts his deal-making skills.
I could certainly help it. I could probably get it done. I would say it would take me the better part of 15 minutes to get that deal done.
But he wasn't talking about Ukraine or tariffs. He was talking about golf. We'll explain why fans are excited about what the new president could mean for their game. Before that, in American politics, what a difference 4 years makes. Not endless delays, arguments over the counting of votes and threats not to certify the result, but a clear-cut result and a pledge from the incumbent to use his 74 remaining days in office to prepare the way for his predecessor's successor.
Yesterday, I spoke with President-elect Trump to congratulate him on his victory, and I assured him that I'd direct my entire administration to work with his team to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition.
President Joe Biden, delivering his first public remarks earlier today on the president-elect's victory, also tried to pour balm on his bruised and demoralized fellow Democrats.
I also hope we can lay to rest the question about the integrity of the American electoral system. It is honest, it is fair, and it is transparent. And it can be trusted, win or lose.
Well, Amanda Renteria was political director of Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. She's an activist in California, Kamala Harris's political base. She also has Latino heritage. Her father emigrated from Mexico, and Latino voters in this election switched significantly to the Republicans. So I started by asking her what went wrong for her party.
Right now in the United States of America, there is very little trust in politicians, in government. And that fundamentally makes it tough for any incumbent. It particularly makes it tough when you're trying to be the first woman and woman of color to reach that highest position.
And what about your party?
In a world that's low-level trust, you really have to start building that simple message that people understand. So part of this messaging about democracy or fascism or the way he was talking to women or people of color, that didn't break through as much as people going into a grocery store and seeing that eggs were a dollar more. That was real. And that's what we needed to be talking to people about. And we should have learned this lesson when the Affordable Care Act passed in the United States. But you can't just pass policies for working people. You need to be able to communicate that at the time and continue that communication so people understand why it matters somebody's in office.
Now, that's very interesting because you're talking about the Affordable Care Act, for which in this country we might translate to the word Obamacare. In other words, the health service reform, which was a pretty fundamental change that was brought in under President Obama. Joe Biden brought in the Inflation Recovery Act. Are you saying that basically once the legislation was passed, the administration kind of stopped selling it?
That's exactly right. You need to go out there just like you're on a campaign and talk about why it's so important people have health care, or why it's so important that in the Inflation Reduction Act, manufacturing investments were made in rural America all across the country. But what you would hear at the door when you're knocking is, hey, I'm really excited about this factory over here, but what has Joe Biden done for me? You know, I mean, those are the kinds of conversation that it shouldn't be a question. They should be linked from the very beginning and all the way through.
Now, that's really interesting because until July of this year, Joe Biden was your candidate. He was running for re-election, and he is a formidably experienced politician. Why did he miss that?
I think it's tough to be in a presidential campaign. I've seen it up close with Hillary Clinton and just how difficult it is to run a campaign while, by the way, being president in a time that's been pretty tumultuous. And so the ability to do both, I think, took its toll on Joe Biden. And you saw that in one of the campaign debates. But for anyone that was working closely, you could see it weighing on him and how difficult that was to both maintain, especially against somebody like Trump, where it is constant. You're being thrown things that you never anticipated.
With hindsight, it seems he should have pulled out sooner. Did it look that way to you earlier in the year?
It did for me, only because whomever else would run would need time to really understand the electorate today, especially coming out of COVID, since the last election wasn't your normal election. We weren't able to learn the same lessons that you do of every campaign. So we knew this one was going to be different. And the ability to have time and adjust, that time just didn't exist given how long Biden has stayed in the race.
You mentioned trust. There are those who said that it sent a message other than trust when the party chose effectively to impose a candidate without any kind of competition, without any opening up. Now, everyone appreciates the timetable was tight. But was that a misstep?
No, I don't think there was any way for anyone to have had a better shot if you had a competitive process. It would have actually made it even shorter for any new candidate to introduce themselves and to put together a campaign. It was just too tight of a process at that point.
I wanted to put to you something that Bernie Sanders, who obviously is an independent but caucuses with Democrats, has said today. No great surprise, he said, working class voters had abandoned the Democrats. First, it was the white working class, and now it is Latino and black voters as well. The swing in particular among Latino voters was striking towards Trump. How big a crisis is this, do you think, for the Democrats in terms of its own sense of identity as the party of the working man and woman?
In talking with a lot of Democratic leaders, I think it's pretty painful, actually. But specifically with the Latino community, it wasn't that long ago where everyone understood how much of a swing vote our community is. And so the idea that we've always been a Democratic-leaning community hasn't been true. And part of what's important in this election, really what it surfaces, is that both parties need to spend some time getting to know this community. And the truth is, it is a hard working-class community. And whoever can win that message and that connection will continue to win elections because of the growing Latino community in this country.
Amanda Renteria. Australia is on course for a major fight with tech companies after the Prime Minister said he would ban those under 16 from accessing social media sites altogether because they're doing real harm to our kids. Anthony Albanese proposed making the companies financially liable if children continue to access Facebook, TikTok and Elon Musk's X and other such platforms. The proposed legislation will be published next week and debated in the Federal Parliament in Canberra before the end of the month. If it becomes law, the companies would have 1 year's grace before it came into effect to give them time to come up with methods for enforcing the age limit. These young Australians are open to change.
But I don't think all social media is bad. I just think it should be very heavily limited.
Well, it's just like really easy to bully people on social media.
I don't know if it should be banned, but I think there should be more restrictions.
The question is, in a year's time, will the companies be able to come up with an enforceable system? And if they don't, what next? Lisa Given is Professor of Information Sciences at RMIT University in Melbourne. Professor Given, thank you very much for joining us so early in the morning from Australia. Can I ask you, first of all, how credible is this plan?
I think this plan to me is actually a very simplistic response. I think when you start to dig into both how we're defining social media as well as the technical issues involved, there are a number of flaws that are coming to the surface.
A number of countries have introduced restrictions or bans for children or teenagers. I mean, Spain passed a law in June banning social media access to the under 16s. Under 14s will be banned from opening social media accounts from January in Florida. And China also restricts the amount of time the under 14s can spend on its version of TikTok. But the question is, how do you enforce this? Because age verification has proved to be really tricky, hasn't it?
Absolutely. An outright ban is almost impossible, really. I think the critical thing here is that the tech companies are going to need to demonstrate what the government calls reasonable steps to keep under 16s off the platforms. But as we know, there will be many workarounds that children may find, from using VPNs or even just accessing an older person's account. And they will find their way. Where there's a will, there's a way.
The government has also said that there will be exemptions for example, the use of social media for school projects and things like that. I mean, the moment you introduce exemptions, you introduce the kind of gaps that people can wiggle through, don't you?
Absolutely. And this is where, again, in one statement, he's saying there will be no exemptions at all for any children, even with parental consent. But then starting to kind of backpedal when you think about, for example, YouTube, that is very heavily used by many people in the schooling sector, and where there's a lot of content created specifically for children.
Just in terms of the practicalities, the onus seems to be being shifted onto the social media companies themselves. What if they just turn around and say, we can't do it?
Absolutely. This is a risk. In theory, they could simply say, we can't do it, or we're not willing to do it. And that may just mean that they decide we won't have access to platforms here in Australia. They could actually just kind of call the government's bluff, and this could end up in legislation as well, or in litigation, in terms of seeing, you know, how are we defining reasonable steps?
One last brief thought, if I may. Do you think this is good politics? I mean, is public opinion with this proposal?
What's interesting is I think the populace is actually quite divided on this one. So even in the last 24 hours, we're seeing many parents saying, I'm already working with my child. I know what platforms they're on. This is an overreach. I think many people feel a one-size-fits-all ban is not the solution. We need different, more targeted approaches with tech companies to be removing harmful content, not just excluding our kids.
Professor Lisa Given, Professor of Information Services at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks very much. Let's return to our main story tonight, the impact of Donald Trump's election victory on Ukraine. The president-elect insists he can thrash out a peace deal, but he also says he can make peace somewhere else, in the embittered world of golf. Trump, an avid golfer whose courses include two in Scotland, one in Ireland, delivered yesterday's victory speech accompanied by a host of supporters. He gave a special shout out to one of them, the winner of this year's US Open, Bryson DeChambeau.
You know, we have up here today the U.S. Open champion. He's a fantastic golfer. He's slightly longer than me. Hits the ball a little bit longer than me. Just a little bit. Bryson DeChambeau is up here someplace.
Well, that love of golf might become even more significant in resolving a major dispute within the game. It's caused by the massive Saudi investments flowing into sport. 3 years ago, Saudi Arabia's public investment fund created the LIV Golfing Tour as a rival to the long-established PGA Tour, using wadges of cash to lure across many of the sport's biggest names. To the shock of many, the Saudi fund then stumped up even more to take a controlling share in the PGA. But the promised merger has been held up by the US Department of Justice over competition concerns. And that's where Mr. Trump may come in. Speaking to a sports podcast ahead of the election, Trump claimed he could get the deal finalised, quote, in about 15 minutes. Music to the ears of eager golf fans. Rory McIlroy appeared to back up Trump's claim when asked about it by an interviewer at the HSBC Championship in Abu Dhabi.
He might be able to. I mean, he's got Elon Musk, who I think is the smartest man in the world beside him, so he might be able to do something if we can get Musk involved too. But it's, yeah, I think from the outside looking in, it's probably a little less complicated than it actually is. But obviously, Trump has a great relationship with Saudi Arabia. He's got a great relationship with golf. He's a lover of golf, so maybe. Who knows?
Well, James Corrigan, golf correspondent at The Telegraph, is also in Abu Dhabi, and he says he picked up early on the excitement among golf fans about Donald Trump's remarks. He told me why the LIV PGA split has been so painful for the sport.
Saudi set up LIV, a rival tour, so the PGA Tour. They took some of the best players, Dustin Johnson, Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, Phil Mickelson, you know, some of the few household names that golf has. They didn't get Rory McIlroy or Tiger Woods, but, you know, they took a fair chunk of the superstars. There was expensive litigation going on, and so suddenly, literally to the surprise of everybody, including some of the big names like Rory and Tiger, there was a framework agreement reached between the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which backs LIV, and the PGA Tour. Now, they said it would be quick. They said it would be an easy alliance to make and an easy merger, but they made one mistake. They said that LIV would not poach any more of the PGA Tour's best players, and the Department of Justice, their ears pricked up and said, well, this is anti-competition. This is against the rules. And so the DOJ then let it be known that any merger or any alliance, they would investigate thoroughly. And it could take years and years getting through the courts and everything. And this has been probably the biggest obstacle to peace being reached in golf civil war.
So when you wrote in The Telegraph before the election that a Donald Trump victory would be good for golf's merger deal, you think it has the potential for him to kind of swipe the Justice Department inquiry away?
The fact that it'll be part of President Trump's executive branch, that, you know, he will bear an influence over it. Rory McIlroy, I'm here in Abu Dhabi, and Rory McIlroy, who's playing here, said yesterday it could clear the way. Trump owns Turnberry, Trump Turnberry, as he calls it, you know, which could be, well, I think is, in the top five golf courses in the world. He owns loads of good golf courses. He's got a very good relationship with the Saudis. They stage live events at his courses. It would make sense for him to get a deal reached because his courses could be used. And as Rory said, he's a golf lover. He probably wants to see a piece in the time and the best players playing with each other again.
How much concern is there inside the sport about this allegation made against the Saudis and the LIV Tour, amongst other sporting activities it's involved in, of effectively sports washing, of kind of cleaning up its own reputation for issues like human rights, treatment of workers inside the country and so on, by using sport to do it?
Yeah, it's an awful thing to say, but this has been going on for 3 years now. We've sort of got a bit blasé with that. Do you know what I mean? It's a terrible thing to say, but I think most people in the industry have realised that LIV isn't going away, the Saudis aren't going away. So otherwise, what do we do? Do we just let this divide go on without end, or do we get everybody back together? You know, it's not just golf, it's the whole of sport, it's boxing, it's football, and it's business as well, isn't it? And I think there is a big feeling in sport and in golf, definitely, that, you know, golf is a business now, and other businesses do, you know, a lot of business in Saudi, so why shouldn't golf?
James Corrigan, just one bit of breaking news to bring you before we go. President Trump has announced his first appointment. Susan Summerall Wiles, who co-chaired his presidential campaign, is to be the new White House Chief of Staff when he takes office at the end of January. That's The World Tonight. Good night.